The so-called engine on my first cruising boat back in 1971 was a far cry from the gleaming beauties beckoning like sirens from today's boat show stands. My primeval Volvo Penta delivered its message by way of an outsourced hydrostatic gearbox which worked when it felt like it. Even when it did oblige, electrical issues and lack of space to swing a starting handle frequently rendered the motor itself sullenly inert. Finally, far up a South American creek, I gave up the struggle. There was no chance of spares. To strip the hydrostatic unit meant slipping the boat, and even if this had been possible, cobbling up wobble plates to a thousandth of an inch in a village blacksmith's shop wasn't what the locals did best. In any case, I'd no money. All wasn't lost, however, because the boat sailed like a witch. With a light heart, therefore, I stowed the socket set, binned my oily rag, slammed the engine box shut for the last time, and wrote the thing off. From then on, I would cruise without power. The feeling of freedom was as unexpected as it was delightful. I didn't have to be back at the office on Monday morning, so the main reason for an auxiliary in today's world was absent. There was little in the way of electronics then, and none on my boat. The accommodation was lit by oil lamps, and spare running lights also burned paraffin, so battery demand was virtually nil. I had to start thinking like a real sailor, of course, never entering harbour, berth or anchorage, without considering how to sail out again. But I soon got used to it. There was no comeuppance of any sort until one spring morning a year or more later, after my wife and I had overwintered in Conwy in the North Wales coast. The boat was almost ready for sea again, although I still hadn't fixed the engine, when I received notification from the RYA to present myself and my yacht in Holyhead for a yachtmaster examination. Apart from the Volvo, everything was in good fettle. The forecast was a gentle southerly, and Holyhead was an easy tide away, so we slipped our mooring and headed out. All went well as far as Point Linus. Here the wind dropped completely, leaving us drifting on a glassy sea. For a while we swirled westward, carried by the tide, but it couldn't last. In due course it turned and carried us back again. Night found us once more off Linus, still without the comfort even of steerage way. We'd often been becalmed before and felt no cause for alarm, but I was now painfully aware of the single oversight in my refit programme. I'd left my navigation lights in my father's garage. We hadn't seen a ship all day, so we'd no worries about being run down, but towards midnight the port of Liverpool opened the floodgates. Traffic began popping up east and west. Bang on their track we were. We could see them, but they couldn't see us. We'd no radio and had never felt the need for one, but as we fired our last white flare at 0200, we began to think a VHF would have been handy to let people know we might be in the way. The flare lit the night like a comet, but the trouble with pyrotechnics is, when they're gone, they're gone. Next, we used our big steamer scarer torch until its trusty ever-ready PP9 battery faded away to nothing. Still no wind, and the ships kept coming. But all was not lost. Our main battery had been charged up ashore before we left, and I had a 25-watt bulb. I also had a length of wire, so I soldered this to the contacts and handed my wife the other end. She held the bare copper onto the battery terminals in the gloomy hole under the cockpit sole, while I balanced on the boom gallows, waving the glim over my head whenever a ship shaped up to pass too close for comfort. Just before dawn, a coaster swept by near enough to smell the bacon frying for breakfast. The cook was leaning over the rail. In the light spilling out from his galley, I could see him waving a fag. "Morning," he called in a rich Scouse accent. "Have you got a light, mate?" Modern engines are a marvel and a privilege. We should not take them for granted.